Hey, you're tuning in to the Email Design Podcast, where we discuss all things email design, development, marketing. We are your hosts for today's program. I am Kevin Mandeville.
And I am Jason Rodriguez.
And we have got an awesome guest episode on the podcast here today, welcoming in to the podcast, all the way from across the pond, is Bex Kim. Bex, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for asking me on. I really, really appreciate it. And I feel honored that you've asked me to do this. So thanks.
Oh, no, we're very excited to have you on. We're trying to get a lot more people onto the podcast lately. And we've seemed to be on a good British roll here lately. A lot of British guests on the podcast, which is pretty cool. So the way we like to start asking everybody, Bex, is how did you get involved in learning HTML, CSS basics? Like, how did you actually get started with all of that?
Well, at sixth form, which is between sort of 16 and 18 years old, I did information technology, and we had a bit of a rubbish teacher, actually. He didn't really teach us a curriculum, and essentially he just ended up teaching me, and there was only two of us in the class, and he taught us how to do HTML, and it sparked something in me, you know. I just found it fascinating. And I think, you know, I've always been very good at languages, and I think, you know, essentially it's a language. Okay, it's not like a conversational language, like speaking French or something like that, but I just found it really easy to pick up, and it just continued through uni. And my degree's in e-business, but some of the units were actually, we had to make an e-commerce shop at one point. And so I managed to use my skills there, and just in my spare time, just learning it a bit more and through various jobs. So yeah, it's just kind of started from there, really. I'm so grateful to that teacher, even though he's a really bad teacher and I got a really bad grade. I'm so thankful to him. And I actually found him on Twitter a few years ago, and I said, thank you so much for teaching me.
Nice.
That's really cool. Actually, I think it's a fun fact, Jason. Paul, our CEO and co-founder at Livness, he actually studied e-business as well.
Yeah.
Seems like e-business had a big trend there for a little while.
Seems to work out well for people, I guess. So that's always good. Yeah.
And after I was going to say, those guys met, you know, not too far away from me. The sort of Litmus office is in Leeds.
Mm-hmm. So. Nice. So after, I guess, university, or maybe even during that, if you're doing freelancing stuff, what were some of the first projects or jobs that you had actually getting paid for doing coding?
Well, I did a sort of placement year at university. So it's like a year in industry. Mm. And that was like a marketing executive role. And part of that role was my boss asked me to make a newsletter. And so I sort of started fiddling around. I think maybe I did PDFs first. I can't really remember, but I realized that I could use the HTML to make email newsletters. And I actually wrote myself a little app, almost, you know, like a very basic MailChimp, so you could change colors and whatnot. And then, that was my first job. And then I actually got a role after that, after I graduated, I got a role as a junior developer, and I had to learn C#, but I really, really didn't like it. So I kind of realized I wanted to be in more web-based roles. So that's what I continued doing after that.
And that, I guess, brings you to your current role at Conversio. Is that correct?
Yeah.
I'd love to hear about what you're actually doing at Conversio, and, you know, you've done a couple of blog posts and stuff about some of the things you've done with email for them. So tell us a little bit about your role there now.
Okay, so my role at Conversio is, well, I don't really have an official job title, but we have to put like fun ones on our on the site. So I just call myself an email wrangler. And essentially my role is to make the templates and all the drag and drop modules for Conversio. I haven't really explained what Conversio does. That might help explain what I do. Okay, so Conversio is essentially a tool for e-commerce stores to monetize things like receipts. We also do abandoned carts and follow-up emails, and we've just introduced a newsletter feature too. And so I write all the code for the templates and all the, you know, content blocks that we, that customers can use to create these types of emails. And I also do the emails that we send out to our customers.
Nice. Our, it seems like there'd be, I've never had to build anything really for any template builders outside of like something like MailChimp's interface. You know, I'm curious if there's any real challenges involved with building those different modules and stuff to work within that system and really make them bulletproof for what your customers are actually going to dump into those emails.
Yeah, it's it is very, very challenging, actually. It's especially, I guess, because our customers are everywhere, so we can't just, you know, try and make emails that don't work in, you know, some of the more specialist German email clients that we have. You know, there's Comcast in Canada, I think. We have to make it work in all those email clients. And we do our best to kind of do that as much as possible, but there's always going to be some email clients that don't work properly. I mean, take for example, I use Fabio's spongy hybrid technique, and I so nearly, after the last Litmus Live, went and did the Fab4 technique, or I was going to use possibly Stig's mobile first techniques. And the first time, actually, when I started working at Conversio, the first thing that I did there was to customize and update the template so that we weren't using cells for spaces. We were using padding, that sort of thing. And I used the spongy hybrid technique there. And it honestly took me about 2 weeks to fully implement it and test it. It was really, really hard work. And there's also some specialist things like we need to do, particularly with our product recommendations, where people will pull in products from their stores, and the products actually have to be, the product images need to be a certain height, and making images a certain height is actually more of a challenge than fixing the width. And so we have to have special code for using it for Outlook and things like that. So yeah, things like that are a real problem. And I'm really glad that I didn't do those Fab4 technique, or because, you know, Gmail updated and actually all that hard work would have been worthless.
Well, I would say it's an interesting point on the Fab4. You know, I'm updating some of our structure and experimenting with new layout stuff. And it definitely is disappointing, because the Gmail app on mobile would be sort of the primary use case that to be for. But you know, Gmail does support media queries, but it's only based on the full window size, not necessarily its parent viewport container for the webmail. So Fab4 is still good for webmails where you have all this extra spacing, like sidebars and stuff, that doesn't really take into account with media queries, because element queries aren't supported yet. So I'm finding frustrations with that, even though we can still target Gmail. But yeah, that is a really interesting point you bring up, is that definitely, if you had done all that and then you finished sort of that revamp, and then Gmail is like, oh, well, the core use case of this is gone.
I think I probably would have cried, you know, because it is so much work, because everything, you know, is an individual files. And then obviously we've got to test combinations, because if you used all of the modules at the same time, then actually it would be over 100 kilobytes, for example. So you'd have clipping in Gmail or something. You know, there's so many possible combinations of the modules that you can have as well, which we also need to test.
Right, and it's a lot harder to change your HTML structure than CSS.
Yeah, exactly.
So what does your actual workflow look like for development? Like, what editor do you use? What are the tools that you use to build and test your email? What's that look like?
I really have quite a simplistic setup. So I just use Sublime, and I also use Atom, because it's easier for managing. I find it's easier for managing stuff when you're using Git. And that's really all I use. And then I just use things like image minifiers. I use JPEG Mini, because I've bought that. I use Tiny PNG when I've got PNGs. I use EasyGIF to try and minify gifts. It's really quite a simple setup.
Are there any specific plugins for either Sublime or Atom that you use, like Emmet or... Do you have like your own snippet library kind of built out at this point?
Oh yeah, definitely. I have my own snippet library, and then a lot of the time I will just copy bits out of my old emails. I should probably make them into snippets, but I just haven't sort of quite got there yet, because when we rebranded from Receiptful to Conversio, I'm still trying to find my feet with how far I can take the branding and how we can use that in email. So I'm still very much in an experimental phase, I guess, with the designs and trying to do something different every time. So the coding's not always, you know, repeatable. Mm.
So I'm interested, you said you use both Sublime and Atom, and that Atom was easier to work with Git. I mean, apart from obviously being created by GitHub, is there anything special, unique to that as to why you feel it's easier to work with and why you use it with that?
I don't know. I think maybe just like the colors when you look in the... I don't really know. But basically, one of my developer colleagues forced me to use it, so I just use it. And all my snippets for my emails that I send to customers, I have in Sublime, and then for Git stuff, I just use Atom. So I switch between the two quite frequently.
I've actually found that too, as I've been using Atom more, specifically for, yeah, like the GitHub workflow, just because I use the GitHub desktop client, and it has like very easy, like open in Atom kind of features, or open in terminal, you know? So just like navigating projects and that kind of structure, I feel like Atom's a little bit easier if you're using that GitHub desktop client, but definitely agree there.
It's, I don't really have a preference over the two. I think they both have their good points and bad points.
So are you inlining CSS by hand?
Yeah. But that's probably because I kind of keep my emails quite short, and so a lot of the styles are already in line because they're in snippets, so I don't have a need to use an external tool right now. And I also have not learned to use Sass yet. I need to at some point, but I've not really had a need so far.
Yeah, because you're not really using like a really advanced build workflow or build tool or anything like that really facilitate the need for SaaS. So yeah, I guess that makes sense. Has the Gmail update really changed your approach at all? Have you like started thinking about moving more of your CSS into the head of the document, or are you still gonna kind of stick with that inline CSS approach?
I think the challenge that we have got as a company is, as I said, we've got to support quite a wide number of different email clients, and there are always some strange requests for email clients that I get from customers that we should support. Have you guys heard of IncrediMail?
I haven't, no.
I've heard of it. I've never used it.
It's super old school, and its selling point is that you can use pictures in the backgrounds and stuff. Anyway, one of our customers was using this, and I actually had to install it on one of our virtual boxes just to see what it was like, and I mean it basically supports nothing, so for that to be able to use stars in the head, yeah, there's no chance. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I guess we can't offer, you know, we can't promise to support everything, and we do say we support all major email clients, but in terms of Gmail, I mean, yes, obviously I would like to start using more stars in the head, definitely, and that's something that I plan to do over time. And we'll see how it goes. But for now, I'm just going to keep inlining things. But we're currently, as a company, working on some things to update our own editor. And I dare say that at that point, we will then start to put things in the head instead. And then if we have to, use an inlining tool afterwards, because it will save me a lot of work as well.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned... It sounds like you use a few different tools for image optimization. Can you explain sort of why that's important to your workflow, or sort of, you know, best tips and tricks you've learned through that process?
Well, I started using JPEG Mini maybe a couple of years ago, I think, when it was just launched. At the time, I mean, I don't remember that TinyPNG did JPEG, so I've been using JPEG Mini. I actually purchased it. It's a great little tool for minifying images. It only does JPEGs, obviously. But TinyPNG also does a great job with the PNGs as well. And EasyGIF I use, although I found a problem with it the other day when I spent ages making an animated GIF, and at the last minute yesterday when I tested it, once I put it into RESP, I sent the email and EasyGIF obviously messed up some of the alpha or something and it didn't work. So these minifying tools are great, but you do have to check that they still kind of look okay. But I just think it's important to, you know, try and keep file sizes down as much as possible, really. And that's one of the ways that you can do it. You know, if I've got an animated GIF, I want it to load straight away as soon as somebody opens that email, you know.
Right. And so how are you testing your emails? And it sounds like you obviously have a lot of even obscure email clients that you're testing for. So how do you test for everything?
Well, obviously I use Litmus. That's my go-to, you know, I will test everything in there. I also have some virtual boxes set up with the Office and Outlook versions in some of the older stuff, because we all work on Macs. I don't think there's even one of our team that has a Windows machine. So I can't ask anyone to test anything. And I also have a number of mobile phones to test with as well. So we've got older Android, I think it's KitKat, and we've got a new modern version of Android, and then obviously we can use their native clients as well. And we have a Sony Xperia to test on. A lot of the time when people ask us stuff about a particular email client, it will only be as a reactive thing rather than a proactive thing of testing. Because like I say, we can't promise to work with every email client.
How do you handle, I think that's like a really good point, is that when you're working with clients, they see something in an email client they might be using, but for the vast majority of their customers, that's not the same email client that they're using. Mm. I feel like a good example of this is I used to work in an agency where we did emails for auto dealers, and the head of like a certain region would be using an older version of Lotus Notes, but these are consumer emails that literally no consumer is going to be running a Lotus Domino server and running Lotus Notes, you know? So how do you handle that kind of client education and I guess educate them about the realities of the email client market share and stuff like that?
Well, I often refer them to the Litmus email client market share site, and I will say, you know, if you guys aren't even, you know, if this particular email client that you have doesn't appear in this chart, then I would not be too concerned with it not displaying properly. And then I obviously reinforce that we do rigorously test our emails and all the popular email clients, and you know, we do our best to support as many email clients as possible.
It's tough. How are you sending those tests? Do you typically, I guess, test by loading everything into your ESP and then sending tests to Litmus and sending tests to your local devices? Or how are you sending tests when you're dealing with local tests?
Because we upload all our images into our FTP, I've already got the files already, so I will test them with Putzmail, and I will send them there and send them to Litmus, or yeah. So then I can, you know, because I have the same email address, my Gmail address that I use for everything, then it just gets distributed to all of the devices, and I can check it. And then I kind of, well, load it into the ESP afterwards. So I will load it into Intercom, and then I will also send a test from there, because there are a few quirks that Intercom will have, and it will sometimes strip out some of my code. So it's always a good idea to double check. But when I'm trying to eradicate, you know, just the obvious stuff from emails, like things not laying out quite right, then I will not put it into Intercom first.
So bringing up Intercom actually leads me to the next question I had for you. You recently wrote a really interesting article on Medium about dealing with essentially opt-ins and opt-outs and preference centers. Specifically, you know, you guys were using Intercom as an ESP. I'd love it if you could walk us through the challenge that you had with this preference center and that kind of solution that you proposed, because I thought it was a really fascinating bit of thought behind preference centers that I feel like a lot of people don't actually consider.
Oh, thanks. That's really nice to hear. And I'm also really grateful that you mentioned it on your previous podcast as well. Essentially, what we had was a problem with communication. And as we're a SaaS startup, one of the biggest issues with any SaaS is communicating to our customers and really getting the customers buy-in so that they will pay for our product. Mm-hmm. We found that with Intercom, there is only the option to unsubscribe. And we have a number of different things running. A customer signs up and they will get an onboarding process, and we're trying to get them bought in through the onboarding process. At the same time, we're also sending them things about new features, or we also have a podcast. All these sorts of things can maybe seem like too much for a customer, and they, once they're unsubscribed, we can't communicate with them at all. So I really wanted to remedy this, and I thought, well, how can we kind of bypass the Intercom unsubscribe and build our own preference center? So I started doing a few tests, and how can we get around it? Because we are, Intercom forces you to kind of have the unsubscribe link in there. And so I'm just at the moment hiding it with some CSS. All it looks for in Intercom is actually whether that link is present in the code. So I'm being a bit sneaky, I'm not going to lie. But we've checked with Intercom, and they said it's kind of fine, because we're not actually stopping the person from unsubscribing at all.
Yeah.
And it's also has the feedback loop. So in Gmail and things like that, the unsubscribe from Intercom is still in there. But we have a process to deal with that as well, which I'll tell you about in a minute. So the preference center, I've seen other preference centers. I actually wrote a piece on my own blog about how Top Cashback had used a preference center. And when I clicked through from one of their emails, it said, oh, you can't unsubscribe from this type of email because it's like an email about billing, or it's a mandatory piece of information that you need to receive. And I thought, oh, that's really clever, because obviously I would have wanted to unsubscribe, but they've explained why I can't do it. And now it's almost like eradicated my need to mark it as a spam complaint or something, because mm-hmm. they've explained why. And so I took that idea and I built a number of different options for our preference center. And so along with one of our developers, we use the preference center to communicate with the Intercom API. One of the other things that I find annoying about a lot of unsubscribe things where you have an account is that you have to log in to access a preference center, which I find super, super annoying. So we have an externally facing one where you don't have to log in, but you can also manage it when you're logged into your account in our account settings. I guess we basically do a number of things. So we check with Intercom. It's a bit of a cycle. So if someone presses the unsubscribe, that's in the header, like the feedback loop one, then Intercom lets us know, and then we resubscribe that person in Intercom, and then we unsubscribe them from all of their options within Conversio. So they're still unsubscribed. It just means that they're not unsubscribed in Intercom.
Yeah.
It's quite complicated, but we're really happy with the way it's worked out for us.
Yeah. Have you found that customers, have you had any direct feedback from them on how much better it's working, or you just kind of know that based on the data that you're tracking?
Well, we've got some numbers to kind of show that it's working. So when we launched this around rebrand time, so I think it was about October time, approximately, I think it was 17% of our database was fully unsubscribed. And now that is down to anyone that signed up after that date, there's only 6% of people are fully unsubscribed now. Nice. So it's a huge difference.
Yeah.
It's a huge difference.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like, yeah, Preference Center is just that one of those weird little overlooked aspects of email marketing that a lot of people don't consider. So yeah, I thought that post was just a really good write-up on what to consider when implementing something on your own. Awesome. We're going to take a quick break and get back to talking to you a little bit about freelancing, which I think is going to be a really rich topic to delve into. But just to remind everybody that you can check out all of our shows of the podcast at emaildesignpodcast.com. You can also follow along on Twitter with the hashtag emaildesignpodcast. If you don't like listening via blog or something like that, then you can find all of our episodes on SoundCloud, iTunes, and YouTube as well. So just subscribe via those channels and you will get updates when we push new podcasts to you. And also want to remind you guys, you can take a free 14-day trial of Litmus. Just for listening to the podcast, go to litmus.com/gift card and use the coupon code podcast, and you'll get access to all of Litmus to take for a spin. You know, the instant previews, builder, testing things in 60 different clients. I think we're fast approaching 70, or we might have.
Yeah, we're over 70 now.
Over 70 now. Yeah, it's hard to keep track of sometimes. Yeah. Analytics, all those good tools, checklist. Definitely take those for a spin and for the 14-day free trial by going to litmus.com/gift card and using the coupon code podcast.
Bex, what would your life be like if you didn't have Litmus to test?
Oh, I don't think I could really do my job very well. I'd spend a lot of time creating virtual boxes to test stuff.
You have the world's most advanced device lab or something like that.
Yeah.
That's the best pitch right there. I just want to ask quickly, Jason, before we jump into some freelancing questions, Bex, do you have sort of, I guess, just a general sense of working with Intercom as an ESP, just because I know some people do it, but it's not necessarily a popular use case of sort of using it as an ESP. I mean, are there any other sort of big challenges around using it that you could relay to other users who might be considering it?
I mean, as you say, it's not really an ESP. It has an email feature. But I mean, there are some annoying things that it does with code. But in general, you know, for segmentation, it is great. And that's what I find one of the best things is to do the segmentation. And obviously, I've mentioned the unsubscribe issues, but I don't know. It's not, the user interface could be better, but I'm hoping that given that they've had a £50 million investment, that will improve and make things better for email. It's just can be a little confusing with the reporting. You know, there's no heat maps or anything like that, which would be nice. And perhaps be a bit clearer about who's unsubscribed, because at the moment it just says failed, which could be bounces or yeah. And no one's really sure.
Interesting.
But in general, I would say it's fine. I mean, it's not MailChimp, but you know, MailChimp wasn't built in the same time as Intercom, so
yeah. Is Intercom the only provider you guys are actually using right now? You don't use anything else?
We use Campaign Monitor for signups that are not our customers.
Okay, yeah.
So we have recruitment on our blog and for various automation series that we have. We've got a couple of ebooks on our site. And so if people want the ebook, then we put them through an automation series through there to get our ebooks.
Nice. Cool. So I guess jumping into the other part of your life and your work, You actually do quite a fair amount of freelancing for email design development. So I'd love to hear, you know, what kind of services you offer. What's your typical process, both from, you know, a development perspective, but more from dealing with clients and living that kind of freelance lifestyle? Because I think that's something that most email designers have done at some point in their career, and some people do that full time. But I know Kevin and I have talked about before, not a lot of people talk about the freelancing aspects of email design. Feel free to dive in and just kind of riff on that.
So freelancing is my side hustle, but it's helped me get pretty much every email job that I've done because it has the benefits of, you know, getting some different experience. A lot of the sort of initial jobs that I had were just, you know, when you work for a single company, you just do their emails. And when you're doing the same emails week in, week out for a company, it can be really hard. So it gives me a much more diverse range of experience. And I kind of, our services that I offer, well, I do design, I do coding, I do consultancy for things like giving people reviews of their current processes, and I'm doing improvements and advise on things like the strategy and how to move forward with their email. And I also offer training through another company who basically do all the legwork for me, and then I just turn up and teach people. And that probably happens about once every 3 months, I'd say. I run a training course. We offer them monthly, but there just isn't really the demand, I think, for people to do it. And I perhaps could probably do a bit more to promote it, but I do all those sorts of things. I mean, it's probably a majority of my work will be very short-term one-off jobs, and it is usually things like builds. I get agencies asking me to do a build or something like that, or to build some automation series. And it's probably, I prefer doing the consultancy stuff, and it's easier to do the consultancy stuff, because if you get a last minute job and you think, oh, it's going to be really easy and I'll just do it tonight, and then at sort of 2 a.m. you're still tearing your hair out as to why something's not working in Outlook. You know, it can be hard. And also, I don't want it to be detrimental to my main job at Conversio. You know, I've never, as much as I maybe in the past wanted to do freelancing as a full-time job, it can be really, really hard to kind of make your way in the world. Dealing with clients actually takes up a lot of time, you know, just even the things that you can't charge for example, when people are phoning you up if there's a problem, all the admin that goes with it. You know, my husband reckoned that when he had his smaller agency, that he probably spent 4 days doing work and then 1 day doing admin, you know. And it's never just a full day of doing something. You're always kind of trying to work through, you know, mix things into the day and get them done. So it's very much just a side hustle, and I really, really enjoy doing it.
Nice. Is there, have you run into any challenges between balancing the freelancing stuff with your full-time job?
No, I mean, I don't sort of think that I have. I mean, it can be stressful when people don't give me enough notice to do stuff, and then suddenly I've got to do something. But I'm very lucky that I work from home, and so essentially I am able to be a bit more flexible with my time. And sometimes I might need to do something in the morning or at lunchtime or something like that, and I don't feel the stress that I would have perhaps if I was working in an office environment, because it's a lot harder to do some other work then.
Yeah, definitely. Do you typically work with a contract then, or is it kind of just like, oh, we'll pay you whatever, just get it done? And if you work with a contract, what's that typical contract look like?
So I don't give people written contracts. People ask me for quotes. We agree the price before we start. Mm-hmm. I, to be honest, if I underquote, I rarely will charge more and say, oh, it took me another 5 hours. If I know it's going to take me a lot longer than what I anticipated, then I will say, look, I'm really sorry. I will have to charge some more. But usually when things take a lot longer than I expected, it's because I've had an issue like in with a particular email client. And then I kind of feel like it's my responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I don't charge for that.
Nice.
But yeah, so I don't give a contract. I have had to sign a few contracts for people just for their own NDAs and that sort of thing around customer data and accessing the systems and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. Do you typically charge hourly or by the project then when you're quoting?
It depends. For a majority of my customers, I do charge hourly just because it's rarely going to be a day rate. And also because I have a full-time job, I always say, well, I just say, well, I'll just charge by the hour. But if I'm honest, I don't tell a lot of people that it is my side hustle because I've lost work through doing that.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And so because people, I don't know whether it's people think that I'm not good enough to do it as a full-time job, but that's why. And I do have, one client who's very, he's a very new client who knows the deal, but they charge a day rate just because that's what we agreed on. And I just do 2 half days a week in their office. But all my other work is remote, by the way. So it's very much just communicate via email or phone call or whatever to get a job, email back and forth and agree on the work. But as I say, a lot of it will be like a build or something like that. So it's like, here's the design files. Can you go and build it for us? So it doesn't really require me having to go into the office to do it.
That makes sense, yeah. So then when you're building that stuff, what does the review process look like when you're working with clients? Do you use any tools? Do you have like a server set up where they can preview the HTML? Do you just send them campaigns to their email accounts? What's that look like?
I usually, I will send them the litmus tests. And then they can look at them in all the different email clients and check they look okay. Then I'll send them the HTML file so they can, you know, have a look themselves. And then it depends whether I might have access to their ESP. A lot of them use MailChimp. So I will load it into their email account and then they can also play about, you know, if it's a template or something like that, they might want to play with some of the features and things like that. And I will also usually write them an instruction guide on how to use it as well.
Nice.
Where do you manage most of that communication and feedback? Is it just email? Are you using a service like Basecamp? How do you sort of manage all of that?
Well, because they're kind of small projects, I don't need to kind of use Basecamp. A lot of it is just by email. Sometimes I'll have phone calls with people depending, you know, if it's something that's a lot easier just to discuss in a phone call, then we'll do that. But sometimes my clients are maybe, I've got an Australian client, so it's really, really hard to kind of find a good time zone for us to chat. So that communication's by email, but a majority is just back and forth on email. It's just easy, you know, or Skype.
Everybody's used to it, so it seems like it'd
be definitely. I mean, it's neat. If the email person isn't using email.
Yeah. Nice. I'm curious about how you go about finding freelance clients then, or if people will actually like seek you out specifically, or like what kind of percentage of your time is spent tracking down jobs in the freelance world.
I don't really go out and look for work. I'm quite happy just to let the work come to me. I guess, you know, I'm fairly active on Twitter and I have a few sort of, I guess I've networked a bit on Twitter with people. I mean, I've got people who recommend me, who know me on Twitter and I've never even met them, which I'm really, really grateful for. And I'm always feel really bad that I don't have any work to recommend back to them. Yeah, I mean, that's really how I get work. And obviously I have a website and people find me through there. I guess if they're searching for like an email marketing person in the UK, there's not so many of us. So I guess that's kind of how they're finding me, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where can people find your site, Bex?
It is bexrivett.com, BECSRIVETT.com. Not the easiest to spell, I will admit.
Nice. One thing you kind of mentioned is that there's definitely this moral aspect to freelancing. So I'd love it if you could talk about that a little bit, how you weigh what jobs to take and if there's ever anything that you won't do.
Absolutely. I mean, I have, I guess, quite a strong moral compass on these things. And I feel quite strongly that I, as an email marketer, I wish to be respected and for people to respect me. And so I will absolutely not send to cold lists and I will not assist anyone who is sending to a cold list or I even suspect is sending to a cold list. Sometimes people have emailed me with like an email design and they've shown me the copy is very much like you can just tell.
Yeah.
You can tell that's being sent to a cold email client. A cold list in an email client. And I'm like, have you bought this list by any chance? They're like, no. Can you build this email? And I basically say, I'm really sorry, but I can't help you with this because I think that you're going to send it to a cold email list and I can't support it. And I also kind of have, I did a job a couple of years ago and I don't feel good about it. I sent or helped a cosmetic surgery company with designed an email for them and it really left a sour taste in my mouth about what that meant because I feel like it's not a good idea to promote additional cosmetic surgery to someone who's vulnerable. It'd be like, hey, you know, you've had it's a liposuction, how about getting your lips done? It kind of feels bad to me. And so when another one of these clients came along, I had to turn them down because I just feel so strongly about it that you shouldn't promote to vulnerable people.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had like a severe backlash against that stance or clients that, you know, get upset by you taking that kind of stance? Or do you try to, I guess maybe in the case of like the cold list type thing, do you try to educate them about the dangers of sending to that type of list?
Absolutely. But a lot of the time, I think it just kind of goes in one ear and out the other. Yeah. They'll find someone else to do it for sure. Yeah. For sure. But for me, I just don't want to support it. I think it's bad for our email community. Mm-hmm. And it gives us all a bad reputation. You know, I don't know about you guys, but the amount of times that I get told that I'm a spammer. I mean, I went to buy a bathroom a few weeks ago and the guy was like, oh, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm an email consultant. And he went, oh yeah, you're the one that spams everyone. And I nearly walked out of the shop, but we really needed a bathroom.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I don't want to have that reputation. And I'm sure it will be around forever because people don't understand the industry. And I'm sure we make jokes, you know, when we meet people from other industries who do a particular thing and we say something that's like quite offensive to them. But for me now, I just kind of want to try and reduce that as much as possible, I guess.
That's awesome.
So I'd love to switch gears a little bit and sort of talk about your opinions on some things. And one of the things that happened recently is we featured you in the Litmus Community Spotlight series that we do on the Litmus blog. And one of the big topics everybody's sort of talking about over the past year or so in email is interactive email. Mm-hmm. And you had stated in the spotlight that you weren't necessarily sold on interactive email, and you've even done a little bit of work on that recently. So I guess I'd love to just ask you to elaborate as to why you think that is and sort of your experience with the process of building interactive emails.
Yeah, so I'm going to I really, it's not my intention to, you know, criticize anybody's work, because I think, you know, Justin Koo and Mark Robbins, you know, the work that they do is absolutely amazing. And when I see the stuff that they do, it blows me away. It's just, for me, I feel that if you, I'm not sure that the money invested in this kind of stuff, if someone's getting paid, someone's paying a lot of money for it, whether that will bring in the amount of income that was invested in it. So from that perspective, take for example the you know, the Burberry email with the scarf, you know, the one with the lettering.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, we featured that on the podcast previously.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that email, I know we won't get figures on kind of how much it made, but that, did that make enough, you know, how much money would that have made by not having that interactivity on it versus having it? I think it's, for me, it's just the cost, the investment in it. But if we don't do these things, then we won't find out what's possible. So, you know, that's the flip side of the coin on that.
Yeah. And I love you being so British polite, but it's okay. We embrace debate here. Let's have a hot take. Let's get this discussion going.
I know, but like, I feel bad because that, I feel like I'm criticizing.
No, it's a totally valid argument. I mean, well, I sort of have the same type of opinion too. I mean, you know, even look at what we do at Litmus. We do it because we sort of have the brand and the audience for it to do cool things, but we don't ever really do it on an ROI basis, right?
Absolutely.
I can understand if that's more of a consideration and something that you need to focus on in your email strategy, which we don't necessarily have to do. Then, yeah, it's totally a big question. And I think it's something that needs to be talked about, whether it really is worth it. But you actually try to do some product review modules in some of the emails that you've built recently. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was hard work. I'm not going to lie. It's my first experience of doing any kind of interactive email stuff, I guess. But my boss, AD, he said, we want to do these product reviews. How can we do them in the email? And I was like, oh, I don't really know. I mean, I know you can use forms a bit in emails. Let's see how we can get this to work. And I did a bit of really, really basic testing with it. And I was like, yeah, sure, it works. We can do it. And thinking, oh, you know, it will never happen. I won't have to do this anyway. Literally a month later, he was like, oh, well, so we're going to be doing this thing now. Can you get it? Can you do these product reviews? And I was like, oh, no. And so I took Justin's email, the image slider stuff that he did, mm-hmm. because it had all the fallback stuff, and I just kind of hacked it about, and I spent ages getting it to work, maybe a week and a half or so getting it to work, and then obviously doing all the testing, because again, you it's all right, you can look at it in an email client, but you know, in the screenshots, but actually you need to really test whether the form's going to submit and stuff like that. The annoying thing is obviously that a lot of them will say, you know, you're submitting this to an external site. Are you sure you want to do this? Which I think for a lot of people is quite concerning with phishing and whatnot. But there's no way to kind of bypass that. So I'd done all this work and I got it working all nicely. And then along comes the Gmail update and I suddenly realized one day before this whole product review thing was going to go live that it no longer worked. And so in that 24 hours, I had to basically go back to the beginning and completely rewrite the whole module, which was, yeah, a bit of a time pressure. But now the email code is really, really simple compared to what it was. The only thing that I have to do now, I think, obviously we have to do something for Outlook desktop clients for Windows, and we actually have to do something for Outlook.com as well because it won't submit the form. So I just have the fallback is essentially that we link to the product, doing a product review online. So we just have to make that work.
So you, yeah. So instead of the interactivity just being right there, you just link out to it as
yeah.
a fallback.
Yeah. But yeah, that was pretty cool. Stressful just finding out that it didn't work the day before.
Yeah, I know. I mean, people don't think email rendering changes a whole lot. And it's, I mean, sure, there's Outlook, which has been consistent for a long time. But outside of that, changes constantly. Mm. Changes all the time. I think people who aren't embedded sort of in doing email day to day don't realize or recognize that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I've just started, you know, I've got to remember maybe every 3 months or so to do like a full test of all our modules and things just to make sure everything's still looking good.
Yeah. So one of the things you said, sort of one of the big challenges that you stated that you believe exists today, sort of in the email world, is just a lack of resources, really. You know, companies not providing enough resources around email design, development, marketing. So two-part question for you. A, why do you think that is? And B, what do you think we all can do as a community to help address that?
Mm, good question. So the challenge, I guess, the resources is that I think people, particularly maybe the older generation or the people higher up in businesses who are maybe a bit more old school, maybe this is just in the UK or maybe in the positions or companies that I've worked in, but they don't believe in email as something which can offer revenue and generate revenue in the same way as other channels. And they therefore do not contribute the resources to getting the right people in or to nurturing the people that are interested potentially. A lot of my junior roles, I guess, were more combined. So I kind of started out doing web development with email, and I was also doing social. So I wore a lot of hats. So there wasn't, I guess, the emphasis put on more on getting someone specifically to do one of those jobs really, really well. And also, as I said, again, it's a lot of junior people maybe doing those roles. And so they're not as well paid. They're probably not motivated enough to want to pursue it. And I guess perhaps what we could do as a community, it would be really nice to be able to nurture more young talent or to get people enthused about it. I would love to see more people learn it, younger people get interested in it, maybe in like school and through education. I'm thinking about actually myself setting up like doing a Skillshare thing to train people how to do email. It's just learning the basics, I think, and teaching people that there is real value in it that we could offer as a community. But it's reaching the people who aren't already interested in it, and that's the challenge, I guess, for us.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like, especially in the kind of like web design world, a lot of people still think email's very old school, which for a lot of businesses it is, you know. Or just refuse to touch email at all. So it's kind of trying to educate them too about the realities of like modern email and, you know, the cool things you can do with it and really how much revenue it does drive for most businesses. So yeah, I think it's definitely, I agree. It's very much an education problem.
Absolutely. And when you've got people like Jeff Zeldman, who regularly tell everyone how much email sucks, it's kind of detrimental to our community as well. So it would be great if we could get some, you know, some more of the web people, I guess, to get more involved with email and understand how good it is or how good it could be.
Yeah, I feel like we're slowly getting there, but it's going to be a long process for sure.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah. So I'm kind of curious, where do you want to see email go next? You seem a little bit hesitant about interactive email. So I guess apart from that, which I think most people are kind of looking towards as the future of email, what do you think the future holds for email?
Well, I mentioned, I guess, in my kind of Q&A that I would like to see more done around the legality aspect of email and how we could kind of help to combat some more of the annoying spammy stuff. And I think it's like people who accidentally spam as well. I am a former food blogger. I used to food blog, but I don't get time anymore. And I'm still getting emails from PR companies who just carbon copy everyone in, or blind carbon copy everyone in, rather than using a professional tool to send emails. And so there's no way of unsubscribing, even though I ask people to stop sending me emails. And that's the kind of things that I would like to see reduced, and more education about that sort of thing, and more action on the people that are consistently spamming. Like, for instance, I had an issue with a company, and we do have the ICO who are supposed to help in these matters, and they decided not to pursue the particular company. And so it feels like, even though there are things in place to be able to deal with these things, they are not doing their job effectively. So I'd like to see more of that, sort of the legality stuff. And I guess in terms of design and things like that, I guess more Flexbox support would be nice. And more web font support. And actually, I was going to talk about this, is I really like a better tool to create graphs. I mean, we do have Google has, although it's deprecated, the Google graphs for creating graphs for emails and things. But I'm always really worried that they're going to take it away because it says it's deprecated. But and it's been like that for maybe 5 years. So who knows when they're going to take it away, and I won't be able to use nice, pretty graph images in my emails anymore.
Yeah, that's interesting. I know there's some like image generator things for charts out there, but yeah, having one specifically for email, that's a really interesting thought. All right, so we're going to wrap up the interview here, Bex. We're going to do what we call rapid fire. We're just going to put like an invisible like 60 seconds on the clock or so, and just come at you with some of your favorite things.
Okay, I'm ready.
You'll just rattle them off one by one. We need to get the sound effects, Jason. Yeah. We actually support sound effects. We just haven't set anything up yet. So we need like, you know, buzzers or, you know, a timer or whatever. But cool. All right. So Bex, what is your favorite email hack?
Mark Robbins OWA hack to do stuff in Outlook, because we use it for our reviews.
Nice. What is your favorite and least favorite email client?
Obviously my favorite email client is Apple Mail, because it supports everything. Least favorite, I think Outlook.com, because it lacks the background properties supports that I would really like to see.
Who is your favorite email designer developer?
Oh, it's so, so hard. But I think, like, I use Fabio's spongy hybrid code every day, but I would say Elliot, because he's always helps me out with code issues and always replies to my request for help on Twitter. He's like the nicest guy.
What is your favorite CSS property?
Oh, again, really hard, but I guess display block for images.
Nice, yeah. What's your favorite blog?
Campaign Monitor, because it's a really wide-ranging kind of blog, so I like all of it.
What's your favorite email newsletter that you subscribe to?
Probably Really Good Emails, but I also really love Action Rockets and Frazee's emails.
Nice. What is your favorite email campaign of all time?
I really like Photo Jojo's emails, because they use like nice little illustrations and stuff, and they're really well laid out. But I also have, and this sounds kind of, I'm not trying to blow my own trumpet, but I really like my email that I did for Joyable, which uses a radar chart using the Google image graph images I was just talking about before, to show people's social anxiety scores.
Oh, I haven't seen that. You'll have to share that with us.
Yeah, I think I've got it on a scope, so I can share that with you guys.
Nice.
Cool. And final question, what would you be doing professionally if not email?
Well, I nearly did shoe design after university, but I ended up not doing it. But I think really if someone told me that email was dead, like right now, and I could no longer do email, I would probably set up a dim sum restaurant.
Nice.
There we go.
I really
all right, well, Bex, This has been so much fun. Thanks for coming on. You definitely win best like microphone that any guest has had to record the podcast.
Oh,
so
thank
far.
You.
So
I
to all future guests, this is the kind of quality we're looking for. Where can people connect with you online, you know, contact, follow you? What would you like to plug?
You can follow me on Twitter. That would be awesome. It's BexKR, which is BECSKR. And you can find me on BexRivet.com as well. That's probably the best ways to find me.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
So we just want to remind everybody you can catch this podcast and every other episode at emaildesignpodcast.com. Full show notes, links, full archive right there. You can subscribe to the podcast, SoundCloud, YouTube, iTunes. Make sure you get the podcast when it drops. Tweet along with the hashtag email design podcast. Jason and I are following along there. And don't forget, free 14-day trial of Litmus. Just go to litmus.com/gift card and input the coupon code podcast. All right, until next time, email geeks. See ya.